RadioInfluence.com.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Monday edition of the Dark Delight Podcast with
Frankie Val on the drums and
Beans. It's Monday, and I wish I could say that we would have a positive start to the week, but we have some things that might be beneficial to folks coming out of this weekend, where we are joined today by Nurse Sarah Absher, who joined us on the first about a month ago, actually, on the podcast. And Sarah and I have gotten to know each other very well in that time. Sarah, thanks for being here today.
Thank you guys for having me again.
So we lost another amazing patriot last night in the hospital, and I don't know if I can say it was to COVID. And I'm not sure you can maybe help, and I don't know how much you want to talk about, but it was Veronica Walski. She was the bridge lady who would stand on bridges with signs and hang them on the signs at overpasses. And she was just an amazing patriot, and she was a friend to many. I mean, let's talk about what's happening in hospital. Sarah, you can take the floor.
Okay. So last time when I talked to you guys, we talked about how you can advocate for a friend or a family member in the hospital. And as I have done more and more of these advocacy cases, it's becoming increasingly clear that there's no consistency. At best, you may be able to get IV vitamins. So all these videos coming out saying you can demand this, you can demand that, they have to do it. Well, I think just like anything that we're seeing in these crazy times, under normal circumstances, you could do all that. The problem is there's not a lot of consistency. So it's better to just avoid the hospital altogether. And that's unfortunate, but it seems to be true.
So basically what's happening is patients are going into hospital. They have power of attorney given to a family member or a friend. And, you know, from personal experience now, the hospitals are just patently ignoring the power of attorney. They're patently ignoring family members looking for updates on conditions. They will not administer medicines even when prescribed by doctors at this point. It's terrifying. And basically what we've seen, now this doesn't happen obviously in every single case, but overwhelmingly what we have seen is that if you go into a hospital, they will push to put you on a ventilator. They will likely put you in the ICU, and they won't treat you with anything other than what the supposed approved treatment is, which in many cases ends up doing more harm than good to patients.
Exactly. And what's so disturbing is it's not just being put on the ventilator, because the person lays there until it probably is appropriate to put them on the ventilator. But in the meantime, putting ivermectin aside, and this is something that I've realized again in this time since I've talked to you, I don't want to say don't try to get ivermectin. It is not the end all be all. If you're just going to get shut down and the minute you say ivermectin, they're like, oh, they're one of these. So I guess I would say pick your battle. If you're later in the disease process, try to push for IV vitamins and nutrition, because this is something that we are seeing, that people are essentially malnourished because they're being stuck in the room in the ICU, a negative pressure room, right, for isolation purposes. And by isolation, I mean infection control. And the staff members will go in there and take care of them, but it's the bare minimum. And again, I'm not trying to generalize, because I know there are so many fantastic nurses and doctors that are working very hard. But for those nurses and doctors who even want to do something for these patients, there's not a lot they can do. If you're a rogue doctor who wants to prescribe something or deviate from the protocols, you risk losing your job. And that is a fact now. Doctors are being told, if you bring up ivermectin again, if you bring up budesonide nebulizers before the patient's vented, if you step out of line, you are done at this hospital.
And it doesn't matter in some cases whether or not you are getting a an ethics panel together or talking to a patient mm-hmm. advocate. The people in these hospitals that we're experiencing this with are completely ignoring their standards of care for patients. Right to try is out the window. They're just blatantly ignoring it. They're isolating people and keeping them completely alone, unable to see family. I have now heard, Sarah, I don't know if you know this. I might not have told you, but I've worked with a few families without alerting you just because of what I've learned doing this. They will take the patient's phone and
yes.
and place it across the room somewhere where they can't get to it. This is actually happening. This is not just some, you know, I've seen this happen where then families are unable to get in touch with their loved ones who are in getting care, and they're unable to get a call back from these doctors, and they're unable to visit them. So then the patient is completely isolated from everything and everyone in a hospital room by themselves, basically just, you know, for lack of a better word, imprisoned there. And I am sorry to say that, but it's true. You know,
it's pretty shocking.
It Presley is a dear friend of mine, and I have held off on talking about his situation out of respect for his family, because I didn't know what they wanted to do. And one of the last texts that I got from Presley was, "Get me out of here. They're killing me." Paraphrasing a little, but basically he was like, "I need to get out of here or I'm going to die." And he sadly was correct. He did choose to go on a ventilator because he was breathing so intently for so long. He was just exhausted. But you have put together for us, Sarah, a list of some things that people can do before they consider going to a hospital, because, you know, from my perspective, they're going into the hospital, right? The hospital's not doing anything more than this, if not less than what we're about to tell you. So tell folks what they can do if they come down with COVID and they, you know, it's early in disease course, or even if they've developed a COVID pneumonia, what are some things that they can do?
Yeah. So, I can start with the do's and don'ts, and I gave this for Tracy to put in the show notes. So, I just threw this together. Basically, COVID is a new disease process, but it mimics a lot of disease processes that we already know about, such as COPD, which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder, and also cystic fibrosis, which of course children have, and you know they don't live till about, I think they now 40 is about as old as they'll live, but it's a buildup of mucus in the lungs. And with COVID, we know it's a buildup of basically pus. COVID infiltrates in the lungs, but that doesn't mean that the interventions aren't the same, especially as far as nursing interventions, which can be done at home. For example, so, okay, do's and don'ts. The biggest thing is anxiety. You yeah. have to try to keep yourself calm. And I wouldn't have been one to say, oh, the mind is such a big part of combating illness, but it's become increasingly clear, I think, to all of us that that is so important. So if you go in with the mindset that this is the kiss of death, you might as well give up, too bad, I have COVID, I'm probably going to die, then you're going to maybe go down that road. And so if you try to, I guess what you would call it is self-soothing or a talk down, and just tell yourself, I feel like death, but I'm not going to die. So yeah. that's one thing. What else am I missing, Tracy and Frank?
Well, it was a lot about, you know, in there, you want to make sure, even if you're in quarantine or you're not around friends and family, that you stay in touch with people, that you talk to clergy, talk to your priest or pastor, you know, get comfort, talk to friends, stay uplifted. Also, you know, getting out of bed and moving around, right? I mean, that's yes. important.
So important. And so now I'll run through the interventions, because when we feel horrible, we want to lay in bed because you just feel like, well, I just feel like death. So I'm just going to go crawl into a hole and lay there till I get better. But that actually is very bad for you, especially with COVID, because blood clots your risk of blood clots goes up when you don't move around, get your blood circulating. And then also the secretions in your lungs can build up, and and exacerbate pneumonia and then cause sections of your lungs to not collapse is a dramatic word, but essentially fill with fluid at the bases. And so you can't oxygenate. You're already not able to oxygenate with COVID that well. And then if you just lay around and just don't exercise, take deep breaths,
you know, get moving, get your lungs working in the hospital. When usually when you have pneumonia in the hospital, they give you a little like machine, like it's like a thing with a ball in it, and you're supposed to breathe into it, right, Sarah? Like so that
yes,
yeah,
yeah. And actually, I did not put that on the list, but that's called an incentive spirometer. And what I tell people is, it's a treadmill for your lungs, and you can actually order, guys. These are like $12 maybe. It's a plastic thing, and you can watch a YouTube video on how to use it. And essentially, it helps you visualize the expansion of your lungs and take good deep breaths. So you expand even the bases, which helps keep your lungs inflated, essentially. And you can do chest physiotherapy. You can have somebody basically bang on your back, is the best way I can explain it, so that it loosens up the mucus. And the other important thing is, I'm seeing this happen when people go to their primary care physician. The primary care physician's like, oh, I'll give you a cough suppressant, because you do get a pretty bad cough with COVID. A lot of people do. Well, suppressing your cough is about the worst thing that you can do. You can take an expectorant like Mucinex, I suppose. But when you take a cough suppressant with codeine or anything like that, you're just, the coughing is an important way to get that junk out of your lungs. And so you're just kind of suppressing the actual, I guess, mechanism to get that up. Bad idea.
And additionally, there is, you can get oxygen prescribed to you at home. That is absolutely something that is available. If you, if your oxygen levels are lower and you say, I really don't want to go to the hospital, I would like to kind of try and fight this out at home. Can I please get oxygen prescribed? They will do that, right, Sarah? I mean, at least sometimes they do. I don't know about some doctors, but.
Yes. And so this is, again, I know last time we talked about establishing care with a physician that you know and trust. I know that is difficult depending on where you live, because the hospital basically owns all the physicians' offices, but at least you're not asking for ivermectin, which of course now has become very controversial. I mean, you can ask for it, but they'll probably tell you no, unless it's a prescribing physician who feels the way we all do. But they may be inclined to order oxygen. You do need a prescription for oxygen, but it's not a narcotic. It's not, you're not asking for anything crazy. So if one doctor says no, I would try to go find another doctor. One thing you might have a hard time doing is getting your insurance to pay for it. So I would encourage everybody to set aside a little cash, yep, especially if times are lean, right? And you don't have a lot of extra income, start putting aside, I guess, a COVID emergency fund. So if, you know, Medicare or Blue Cross Blue Shield says, no, you're not really sick enough, you don't qualify for oxygen. It's like, by the time you qualify for oxygen, you're going to be in the hospital. So if they're not willing to pay for it, you can say, I'm going to cash pay. And if your doctor's any good, they'll just write you a prescription and let you or a family member call around to medical supply companies and try to negotiate a price. You'd be surprised. A lot of them, if you say, hey, I'm cash pay, you guys have to be ready to fight for yourself before going into the hospital, and just take no as a not with this person and try to explore other options.
So
don't just resign yourself.
Yeah. And you know, look, they're basically, what we're seeing now is that ivermectin has become the new, I don't know, like killer.
Hydroxychloroquine.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, seriously. And I just watched an FLCCC Alliance video last night. I think one of the patients, Sarah, was the one in Chicago that was on. What was the attorney's name from New York or wherever he was from?
Ralph LaRaggia.
Yeah. He was on talking about the interventions that he had to make for patients in hospital to get them ivermectin in hospital. And even in one of the cases that I was watching, the hospital just didn't follow the court order for no good reason whatsoever. And then there was an order that the patient get this medicine on their own somehow, and they got it and delivered it, and the hospital lost it, in quotes. You know, this is what's, I mean, I've never in my life experienced something so absolutely disgusting and criminal where you're going to withhold a perfectly safe medication from somebody for no good reason other than there's nothing else coming into my head, but they want people to die. That keeps just, it doesn't seem to me in the cases that I have seen, and there have been several, that the hospital wants people to get better. It's just my personal opinion. So we have to try and keep people out of the hospital. And that's what we need to start doing. Early treatment is so important. And again, they're removing one of the ways that we can early treat from us by saying it's now on back order. Nobody will dispense it. I don't know where we, really go from here other than some of the other early treatment options that have been offered. What do you do if you're a patient and you get COVID and you don't get on medicine right away or what else can you do to beat this virus at home?
So this is why it is important to think ahead, just like you have smoke detectors in your house and hopefully have a fire plan, do a COVID fire drill, and start to think about what would I do? So even if you can't find a physician, so as far as medicines go, yeah, it's becoming increasingly hard. I think the jig is up. They're on to our game of there hasn't been a massive outbreak of scabies across the country, and this is what the ivermectin's being prescribed for. So I want to give you a good answer. So let me think about this. The most important thing is if you don't have medicine, to just take a deep breath and start calling around to friends and get a team together, because it's an all hands on deck situation. So if you have a nurse friend, she may have a doctor friend who may know of a company that will sell you some oxygen. It's time to start leaning on your church connections. Say, oh, the lady I go to Sunday school with, I think she is a nurse. Let me call her. And it doesn't have to be about ivermectin or anything controversial. You don't have to say whether you've been vaccinated or not been vaccinated, because now we are seeing vaccinated people get COVID. So I'm not saying lie, but also this needs to stop becoming, oh, well, look, you didn't get vaccinated, so this is your punishment. You just have to die a horrible death alone.
And that's a big thing, right? I mean, people are dying completely alone with nobody around them. And I don't know how we can, there just needs to be a ridiculous amount of awareness now. Now, it should have been already happening, but this is happening to people all over the country about what these hospitals are doing to their patients. It needs to be screamed.
It does. And actually, Frank, you remember you told, it was a while ago, but it was a really chilling story. Because I've heard a lot of these, the person died alone stories, but you were talking about someone who went to an urgent care. Their husband goes through the door. And of course, this is at the beginning, so they're not allowed even back in the urgent care. The ambulance whisks this guy away, and then the wife never sees him again.
Well, never sees him on his feet again, that's for sure. It's a friend of mine. We work out together. And his father was a older diabetic, so he was in that high risk group, and he just went to the clinic because he didn't feel too good, but walked in under his own power, and his mother's waiting outside for over an hour at that point, just saying, well, what's going on here? And they just rush him out the back door to a hospital in an ambulance. I think there was limited contact in between there, but he never saw the light of day again. And it was just after a couple of weeks, the organs are shutting down because he was intubated and everything was going wrong with him. And I don't know, they tried doing dialysis at one point toward the end, and we just couldn't believe the updates as they were coming in. And here we are, lay people. What the hell do we know? Our instinct said this hospital is killing our friend's father. Our instincts said that. And, but it's hard to vocalize that, especially to someone who's going through it. But now here we are a year later and something worse is happening. So it's just what it is.
It's pretty shocking. And yeah, that brings me to another point. So one, I guess we have to just practice medicine like robots. We can't think for ourselves. And we are seeing that I saw it before COVID. So I saw it. I think the culprit is the third party payer system. So your insurance, your Medicare, your Medicaid. In fact, we just had Joe Biden announce that any physician who is participating in Medicare and Medicaid, and the insurance companies always follow suit, by the way. So this is basically, if you don't have an all cash practice and you or your staff are not vaccinated, well, guess what? No Medicare dollars for you. I hope the person who, if they still want to keep seeing you, I hope they can pay, because you don't get to participate in Medicare as a provider. And that's just, that's a whole nother conversation. But so the third party payer system started to dictate, this is right after healthcare reform, it got particularly bad. We only pay this amount of money for this disease process, because all, if somebody has pneumonia, it should be 3 days of hospitalization. And if it's any longer than that, it's probably your fault, hospital. So forget you. We're just going to pay this. Well, then that turned into an army of administrators starting to dictate how hospital courses must go in order to squeeze the maximum amount of dollar from Medicare and Medicaid. And what you get then is, we must treat this disease like this. So even if you have a creative doctor, even if you have a doctor who's like, yeah, we're not doing any good here, this, what we're doing is not working, if that doctor speaks up, maybe if they're senior enough, yeah, and they might not get fired, but let's just say it's frowned upon. So that research grant that they were promised might go away, that, you know, they might lose their. And again, I'm not justifying that this is a reason to stay silent. I mean, I think if all of us healthcare professionals spoke up, despite the consequences, but I also realize that people have mortgages. And so it is a very hard thing, but it goes back to something that I think we're all starting to become aware of, is there is no amount of kowtowing that will stop this. In fact, it's making it worse. So we have to put our foot down throughout all sectors. And going back to isolation, I've thought about this a lot, and there are strict rules on restraint and what we call seclusion. Usually it's used for mental health patients. So sometimes the mental health patient might be a danger to themselves or others, very violent. And so there are procedures that you can follow to put them either in soft restraints so that they're not. I had a patient, even though he was in wrist restraints, still kicked me in the head one time. But this, it wasn't his fault. He had a brain tumor, and it was kind of, you know, it just is what it is. But the hospital takes this stuff very seriously. And so does, it's called Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. They kind of, I guess, certify which hospitals can participate in these programs and basically get paid. And so if you don't follow these guidelines, you're in big trouble as a hospital. But again, restraints and seclusion are under the same regulation. And so when you seclude somebody, there is a time limit on that. And so, of course, these doctors are saying, oh, we follow CDC protocols. Well, I verified this again on the CDC website. They say, even if someone has very bad disease, after 20 days, that person is no longer infective. Well, for these people who have month-long hospitalizations, they still won't let you in. And their rationale is, well, infection control. Of course, they won't show you those policies because I think they're making them up as they go along. But so if that's the rationale, well, then they're no longer following CDC guidelines. And again, if you point this out, they don't care. They just hang up the phone and go, oh, well, the doctor's too busy to talk to you. So people are being shut out. And this is where I think the audience, your audience, all of us patriots, we have to start educating our state representatives. That's a good start. And then maybe hopefully at the federal level, we need to start demanding that lawmakers pass legislation that says, no, I don't care if they're day one of COVID, they can have one visitor, a spouse or whatever. It doesn't have to be everybody and their mom, the whole family in the church, but one visitor to advocate for them. We need to start demanding that of our representatives.
There needs to be some way for a family member to be intimately involved in the care of their loved one. And there should be no excuse for why that's not allowed. You know, when I was sick in college with some weird ass virus or bacteria, they had no idea what I had. An infectious disease was coming in a literal suit from head to toe with a visor, you know, and like he looked like a moon man to treat me because they had no idea what I had. My mom and dad were allowed in the room with me. They didn't keep my parents from me. They let them in. That there is no good reason why in PPE a family member shouldn't be able to advocate for their loved one. And we need to start looking at some of the treatments that are being given in the hospital just as like a default, like remdesivir, for example, which in all of the cases I've seen has, and this is just me personally, I'm not talking about like all across the country, but anybody that I know who has been in hospital given remdesivir has quickly worsened their kidneys. They start retaining fluid. They're not, you know, they're talking about dialysis for these patients. Like at the end of Presley's life, when he was vented, he was not voiding and they were talking about giving him kidney dialysis. And it wasn't because of the COVID, in my opinion, it was because of the drug cocktail they gave him that did absolutely zero to help him through COVID at all.
Right. If you don't, there is a window with COVID, the acute illness too. So we know there's a window with early treatment to avoid acute illness. And sometimes, guys, just to let you know, it doesn't always work. You could have, I'm not trying to scare anybody, but I think now people have fixated on the ivermectin cocktail as like, this is going to fix everything. It may, it works well, it seems, but just like any medicine, we have to stop thinking of COVID as something different. I think that that's what's really causing the mass psychosis. Like you said, Tracy, never have we had a disease process where the hospital won't let you in. And I've seen some gnarly infectious diseases, mostly, honestly, superbugs that were created in the hospital, resistant to every antibiotic under the sun. We still let their family in. Now we have strict rules for the family to use PPE. We show them how to use that. But this mass psychosis has caused everybody to just lose their mind and forget how to be normal. And so we have to, just like we have to push back and stop wearing our masks in the grocery store if it's not appropriate, we need to make our own decisions about that, not just because somebody told us and we're going to get a nasty look or a Karen's going to say something mean to us. We have to start using our brain in these other situations. So there is a window with early treatment and most of the time it works. Once you've passed that window, then there's also another window of late treatment, meaning whether you're in the hospital or at home and try to throw everything at it. Once you're talking about dialysis, once you're talking about intubation, again, miracles happen. And I believe in the power of prayer. I really do. But there comes a time where it's just a downhill trajectory because the organs do shut down. It's probably the cytokine storm. I think there's more things at play. And nobody stopped to say, hey, is what we're doing working? And by the way, this is nothing new in medicine. I will just say that. The new thing in medicine is it's a centralized, you don't even have the ability for that one kind of rogue physician anymore to stand up and be heard. But I don't know if you guys have thought about this, but why is it that nurses don't wear white caps anymore? Well, the reason is because in the 70s, I think there was a study done run by nurses. And basically, they realized that the starch in the white caps is a breeding ground for bacteria because starch is just sugar and bacteria like sugar. And so it took that long, years and years, for us to go, I wonder if this cap is carrying, you know, as we're leaning over a patient, they're breathing on it, and then we lean over another patient, is that transmitting germs? And to really, right. So, and if you look back even further, a lot of women were dying in childbirth, and it was because these, not to be graphic, but these medical students were, you know, go from the morgue and dissect and then go and deliver the child. They didn't believe in hand washing. This was like way back when, but you know, the person, I forget his name, but this one doctor who kind of introduced the idea of trying to be as aseptic as possible. So it's not sterile, asepsis is just as few germs as possible. Really pioneered those techniques, was laughed at. Like, wash hands between patients. What are you talking about, crazy? So we've been like that. Medicine's been like that. So it's up to all of us to say, well, have you really thought about, does remdesivir really increase 28 days survival? And the answer is no. There are studies saying, no, it does not increase survival. So why are we giving it?
You know, it's funny because we'll give that, right? And nobody will think anything of the mortality rate from it, which is very well documented in study, right? We'll give that in the hospital just fine. But a pill with a better safety profile than Tylenol, we can't try. You know, this is the kind of thinking that we've got going on here. And again, What do you do when your body's in a cytokine storm, Sarah? You decrease inflammation. How do you do that? There are plenty of ways to decrease inflammation in the body. High dose vitamin C will do it. There are nutraceuticals like NAC that they've now banned that will do it. Even
turmeric,
yes. And melatonin is an anti-inflammatory as well. When Presley was in the hospital, they started giving him 6 milligrams melatonin every night. And he would say that he would feel better the next day when he took the melatonin. I said, keep asking for more melatonin. They don't realize it's helping you. That's the kind of conversation you have to have with people now. If they know that something's helping you, it seems to me, honestly, they don't do it anymore. I don't know if that's just my experience because I've been involved with patients at this point now where this has been the case, or if it's what do you think about that? Because you've seen that too, right?
Oh yeah. And I don't know if it's cognitive dissonance. It's really hard for me to think that people who have dedicated their lives to being doctors and nurses and respiratory therapists, it's hard for me to believe that people really want to hurt people. I think there is this has become, by making it political, and of course we've seen, I saw one in the WAPO, well, I saw it on Twitter because I don't read the WAPO, but basically this opinion piece, someone not a medical professional, but said, oh, you know, the vaccinated people should get resources first. And so by othering the unvaccinated, because of course the party line is that everybody who's dying of COVID still is unvaccinated, which is not true, guys. 50% now, it seems like, depending on who you ask. And of course, we don't have
numbers.
We don't have numbers. And this is a side note, but everybody should be very skeptical when the news so confidently throws percentages out of hospitalizations, because it's up to the individual hospital to report that. Shockingly, the CDC, the FDA, they don't keep that data.
Nope.
Interestingly, the health department might, but it's not something that the hospital has to report every day. Like, oh, this many people. They can, but we have no way of verifying these. And so I'm always curious to know, well, where did you get that information? Can I have a link to that data set? We need to start questioning on that level, because as we see with propaganda, this has been a recurring theme. You know, we see something gets spouted by one person and then it's just like mimicked all over, and nobody stops to ask, well, where did you get those numbers exactly? What does unvaccinated even mean, right? Because
about this the other day, Sarah, on the show, where 13 days after your second shot, you're still considered unvaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that.
Numbers are being manipulated, whether it's on purpose or not. So I don't know. It's hard for me to think that people would really be doing intentional harm to people. I think it's, and this is where, you know, I have to say, this must be what evil looks like, because it's just easier to go along, to get along. And so maybe it's too hard for people to stand up and really think critically, and they're scared. And so it's up to us who are awake to force people to look at reality.
Reality is this. Most people who get COVID still survive COVID, right?
Yes.
It's just true. I know that we're talking about the worst cases right now, but there are a lot of people out there who get COVID and survive. A lot. 99.8% of the people who get COVID survive.
Yeah, that's the last. Now, I don't know. Are we going to see that change? We are seeing a shift in demographics. Again, this is not a scientific thing because we don't have the official data sets. But obviously, I'm friends with a lot of nurses, and I do hear that we are seeing more and more vaccinated go into the hospital with severe disease. So that narrative is kind of crumbling. Israel, obviously, we see more vaccinated. It is a highly vaccinated population. So, but I'm wondering if now we are, because of evolutionary pressure, and Dr. McCullough talked about this on your podcast, are the variants we create, are they going to be worse for different people? I don't know.
Well, I have from Geert Vandenbosch a couple of days ago, he posted, he said, this is part of his little article, as an independent expert, I've come to the conclusion that if stakeholders override the emergency brake, it's better to concentrate on solutions for when the crash takes place. The wake-up shock is unlikely to occur before the percentage of COVID-19 disease and death in vaccines largely exceeds that observed in the unvaccinated group in at least several of the, quote, model countries. In parentheses, he says, let's hope that by then we will still have an unvaccinated control group. And we've talked about this a lot, that now with this push, the only way for them to escape the horrible thing they've caused is to mass vaccinate the entire population. So there is no more control group, because it seems to me that even in these more virulent strains that are being created in the vaccinated, because they're, you know, leaky vaccines, are more tolerable for those unvaccinated than vaccinated. And that's what he says throughout this entire 10,000 word piece that I was reading, because he never mentions what happens to unvaccinated people as these things mutate. He says still that natural T cell immunity is the most robust immunity that one can have. And again, I don't want this to be a completely doom and gloom podcast, but I need people to understand what's happening in the hospitals and that there is early treatment available. And I know that it's not as easy to get some of the things on that protocol any longer, but there are still things that you can do nutraceutically. I'm sorry, I don't know, Sarah, if you're going to back me on this, but the nasal rinse and gargle, I think, yes. I honestly really believe that that was huge for keeping, the spread of COVID in my household under, you know, at bay. My daughter was using correctly. My son was not. And so no one else in my house caught COVID from my son. And I was in front of him, you know, taking care of him. It replicates in the nasopharynx, correct?
Yes. It starts as an upper respiratory infection. And we know if we can disrupt the binding and the replication of the virus, it may not turn into a lower respiratory infection. So, you know, if you are exposed, you don't need to freak out if you don't have a pile of ivermectin. We have to, again, our brains are trained to say, what pill fixes this disease? We must start looking past that. We must. Because if we don't, we are telling ourselves the only person that can save me from this is a doctor. I must find a doctor who's willing to prescribe ivermectin. We need to start taking responsibility. You got to do everything that you can, because by the way, not doing this other stuff like chest PT and moving around and taking good deep breaths, they are going to the hospital and they're in the same position. And guess what? The hospital's not going to allow you to take your ivermectin. You can bring it with you. You can, they're going to take it. They're going to whisk it away from you and never see it again. So it's important to think of this holistically and not fall into that trap of a pill for every ill. Yeah.
Because there are things that you, again, getting active, the percussion and the palpitation, the home oxygen, if you need it. Oh, another thing you put in the sheet was don't obsess over your O2 levels. Why do you say that? Your pulse ox?
So, yeah, this is something I saw in new doctors as well when I worked at a teaching hospital, to this obsession with treating the machine and the data and not the patient. If you're starting to freak out and say, my pulse oximeter is reading 84%, you know, ideal is 100%, but you know, anything really above 92 is okay. It'll be fine. But if it does drop down to, you know, 86, and you're just like, and then of course you can think of yourself as being nervous about something, you're going to hyperventilate, you're not going to oxygenate as well. You got to stop and say, well, wait a second. Yes, I know this is what this number says, but can I breathe? I don't know, you know, and then take a deep breath, get up, move around. It can be as easy, guys, as it's positioned wrong on your finger. These, especially the home ones, they're not hospital grade. They're not that great. Even the ones in the hospital aren't that great. If you have nail polish on, guys, especially the acrylics or gel nail polish, they don't read right. If your fingers are cold, they don't read right. You can actually put them on your ears, especially if you're a guy with like big earlobe. So you have to start getting creative. And again, don't just start to freak out and spiral into, I mean, we have all spiraled, whether it's, I have to cook a big Thanksgiving dinner and they're out of cranberry sauce. And now the whole Thanksgiving is ruined. I mean, we've all gotten into spirals, and the problem with COVID is we're also afraid of it.
Yep.
That we go down that road, and then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy almost, it seems.
You don't have to get seriously ill with COVID. I know plenty of people that haven't. And I know a lot of people who have gotten the monoclonal antibodies and have really bounced back really well from them. Those are those tend to be available now much more so than before, even though last week the government came out and said, we're rationing these out because too many people are using them, of course. We're in a really rough spot right now with this virus because there are a lot of factors. There's politicization, there's tyrannical government. Sarah, I know you got to jump off because you've got stuff going on, but I wanted to thank you for joining us today. And I'm going to be putting your little guide, which is very helpful, into PDF form and putting a link to it in the show notes. And you'll be back soon, I'm sure, because there's going to be more that we need to talk about. But thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you guys so much for having me. And I'll just leave with this. Please, everybody, pop the hood on your local hospital and ask them what's happening. Why aren't visitors allowed after X amount of days? Put pressure on your state representatives, because I think that that's going to be the next step. I think we need to start doing that as a activist community. So anyway, thank you, Tracy and Frank.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you.
Well, that was down. It was very depressing, but I'm in a depressed mood today because it was depressing, but not. I don't even know what to really say. I mean, I just think people need to be awake and aware about what the hell is happening in these hospitals. I don't know that it's every hospital, Frank. I really don't. But in the people that have reached out to me and said, please help me, my mom or dad is in the hospital and they won't, and then I'm like, oh no. And I pull in as many resources as I can and everybody scrambles and tries to get a team and I make connections and here, talk to this person, that, and then we wait. And it hasn't been turning out well. It hasn't.
If you walk into a hospital with the birth plan that you and your wife put together, or you and your husband put together for you having your child, and 9 times out of 10, you get either a visible roll of the eyes or a energetic roll of the eyes. As in, okay, look at this, these two noobs coming in here telling us how to do it. We're going to get your baby out. Don't worry. Just lay there and take it. If you think that you're not going to have any, you have like bad luck with that. And if you take that up a couple more notches, you come in with your own plan or even your own prescribed plan from your own doctor into a hospital to engage in a treatment protocol that is going to possibly create a positive trend of people getting better outside of what everybody has committed themselves to, like kamikaze pilots with vaccination and intubation and suffocating amount of propaganda, then you're out of your mind. I mean, you said before we're seeing new challenges with this virus, but it's, you know, how much of it, well, the challenge is not the virus. The challenge, there's always going to be disease that pops up. And if you're a sane society, you just do what you got to do and you find what works and you hunker down and you try to figure things out while maintaining people's freedom and just being honest with people about what can be done if you really want to save lives. That's not the case. The challenge is not the virus. If the challenge was the virus, we would have been past this last spring.
Yeah. Yeah.
Last spring, we would have been past this.
You've got this.
This is a very, very valuable tool. And they do not care about killing people. And yeah, there are plenty of people still in the hospital systems that believe in the vaccine, that believe in the protocols and all that, but don't actually want people to die. They've actually been made to believe this is the only way because they're the way that they were brought up in this business to them is the height of medicine. That's it. And of course, there are people higher up the chain that understand the more people die, the better this is for them. Yeah. So I don't know. We're dealing with absolute evil.
Yeah.
Evil.
It is. Between the vaccine push, which I have a bunch of stuff on today, because I mean, after we lost our friend last night, who I never met, I just was brought in to try and help. God bless her. She's terrible. After that, Sarah and I were talking this morning and we just were both so frustrated with what's happening in the hospital cases that we have been trying to look at. And I was like, can you come on and just talk about this and, you know, talk about ways to just stay out of the hospital? Because, again, it is a survivable virus. It is. the Delta variant seems to be, or whatever variant is running around or whatever it is, seems to be much more infectious, i.e. more people get it because it's more transmissible. But for a lot of people, like I know a lot of people here who got it and it was just basically like a really bad cold and they were off to the races. But they were also the people that were doing nutraceutical prophylaxis with zinc and quercetin and, you know, liposomal vitamin C and NAC and, you know, all these other remedy to prep themselves for, God forbid, if they were to get sick, what would they do? And it, I'm tired of it, Frank. We can't stop talking about it because it's this important. I feel like humanity is kind of on a precipice right now. But I just want a day to go by where I don't have to think about this.
It is consuming
and it's terrible. And I get emails every single day from people like it is. I want to wake up in the morning and not turn on my phone and read all of this horror. It's terrible. Listen to this.
I absolutely think we should have that requirement. I think it was a major oversight on the part of the Biden administration to not issue this yesterday. And we have to talk about the reason. The reason isn't so much that we need to keep our train travel and plane travel even safer. They are pretty safe, although I definitely think that having a vaccine requirement would make it even safer and probably encourage many people who are vaccinated or who have young kids and want to protect them. Maybe it'll help to encourage those people to start traveling again. But there's an even bigger reason too, which is I think we really need to make it clear that there are privileges associated with being an American, that if you wish to have these privileges, you need to get vaccinated.
No, we're not in China. You tyrant little sycophantic. We're not in China. Okay. We're in the United States of America. Privileges, the freedom of movement.
There's very little I can say. Especially when I hear the humming voice of that homunculus popping up every once in a while. There's really, and you see the other two assholes on CNN sitting there with the 1,000-yard stare, the fluoride stare, just completely emotionless as she says the most outrageous things. They just sit there and let her just seed the minds of whoever's still watching that wretched network. These people cannot be negotiated with. They are absolutely evil, and there is nothing that could be done unless there's a fight. I'm sorry. You can edit that out if you think it's necessary, but it's going to come down to that because they will not stop.
There's a post on Facebook that we're writing a piece on. It should be out later today by the time this airs. It was WXYZ TV Channel 7 on Facebook that posted this. After the vaccines were available to everyone, did you lose an unvaccinated loved one to COVID-19? If you're willing to share your family story, please DM us your contact information. We may reach out for a story we're working on, right? There are 30,000 comments on this. None of them are anything but people who are vaccinated who died from COVID, people who are vaccinated who died from being vaccinated.
And you want to know something else? Where, as I said on Friday, it was Friday afternoon, because it's when I saw Leanna Wen do her thing and one thing or another. But still, seriously, until someone can produce a study, which is an impossible study to produce, that shows how many unvaccinated people are infecting vaccinated people more than vaccinated people infect each other. And the unvaccinated, all of this is Trojan horse, bullshit, tyranny, evil. There is no way. There's no way you can even tell who I can be in a room with a vaccinated person and an unvaccinated person. And some people can get sick, or the vaccinated person gets sick. One of us gets it. You don't know who gave what to who. You don't know, especially when nobody really even has a discernible advantage over the other. Everybody's still giving and getting this thing. The only thing that you're really asking yourself is the real question is how many people are unvaccinated people are vaccinated people getting sick, and what kind of mutations are vaccinated people sloughing along?
Yeah,
how that's the real question there, because there's nothing else that the vaccine provides except supposedly a little bit more of a milder stay in the hospital. There is, so all of this is lies. Nobody can defend it. Nobody can prove it. That's the question to be asking. Prove to me how the unvaccinated are infecting the vaccinated more than the vaccinated are affecting each other.
They can't.
Obviously. You cannot do it. So then all of this is bullshit. If you supposedly, and especially if what Joe Biden is saying is true, that they've gotten 70% of the country or something close to that vaccinated, then what the hell are you? If this is really the miracle that you said it was, this miracle technology that you said it was, what is this about? It's about getting rid of the control group, and it's about making sure that in the hospitals from coast to coast, which is where most people go when they feel very, very ill, it's just so unfair for anybody that's paying attention here to think, wow, if I really feel ill, it might as well be the year 1600.
Yeah.
There is no hospital I can go to.
Yep.
You know?
Because if you go in and you say you didn't get the vaccine, what are they going to do? They treat you like a state. They don't treat you. This is happening. We're seeing vaccine.
And then you become the punchline of a Jimmy Kimmel joke.
And somebody, you know, Newsweek wrote an article, QAnon follower who demanded ivermectin dies in hospital. Go f- yourself.
Yeah. Did they meet the demand? No, they just died.
A new clip on Disclosed TV. I don't know that it has. It's in a different language from what I can see. Hold on one second. Let me just pause this really quickly. I'm just going to say what Disclosed is saying. They're saying new Israeli Minister of Health recorded on hot mic saying to the Minister of Interior, quote, "There is no medical or epidemiological justification for the COVID passport. It is only intended to pressure the unvaccinated to vaccinate."
Duh.
Are we surprised?
Nope. There's a race against the clock. We just don't know what's on the other side of midnight. That's the only thing here. I mean, we have an idea. People like Gert Van Den Bosch, and I saw that very same thing that you brought up with Sarah. I was going to bring it up on my show tonight. We've got a pretty good idea from people like Gert Van Den Bosch about what may be on the other side of midnight. But there is a race. There's a race against the clock right now. And they need to get as many people jabbed and injected as possible.
He doesn't even think it's going to be months before all of the vaccinated people start, you know, experiencing some of the more rough disease processes like ADE and other stuff.
But that's the thing. When they start going through that, if that happens, what does that mean for the unvaccinated? Do we have to really seek shelter because these people are exploding with disease? Or is this something that is going to be customized for them because the vaccines have already destroyed their innate immune system so much?
And I have been asking that question and desperately seeking some answer. And finally, yesterday, he started talking about it briefly. From what I gathered in his last piece that I will share on the show notes today, we are in a much better spot. A much better spot, even with he doesn't ever say that the virus will necessarily become more lethal. He just says that many, many, many more people will become infected and therefore there will be more mortality because not every single person survives COVID, right? But he never says that we are, you know, going to experience more deadly disease in the unvaccinated population. To the contrary, okay, is what he says. And he actually mentions ivermectin in his piece as a potential to stop this virus. So it's interesting to me because he uses the India example and he uses a few other countries where now we have very good data about when they implemented prophylaxis ivermectin across the board and when they didn't. And I know it doesn't work in every case. It really doesn't. I know somebody who got sick here who was taking it. It didn't work for them. And there are a million reasons why they started it later in, you know what I mean? There are like tons of reasons why that could be possible. Sometimes people just don't respond to medications the same as other people. You know what I mean? It's not like that's why Sarah was saying, I think it's not like a magic wand per se, but for the very good majority of people in all of these double blind studies that are now very much available, it works to decrease severe disease hospitalization and death. So he mentions that in his thing. And he also says it's really ADE that is going to be a problem for the vaccinated, especially vaccinated who get sick and then are quickly re-exposed to COVID again in this 6-week period after they've gotten it once. It's a little, as his articles always are, medical and complex, but he did kind of dumb it down for the general masses. And he does say, you know, some things about isolation in case of a horrible outbreak of disease. But it's a good piece to read, because I was waiting for someone, Frank, to tell me what happens to the unvaccinated people. What happens to us?
Yeah. Yeah. Because I've been wanting to know that for a while. How much do we really need to take what is going on inside the bodies of those who have been injected? How seriously do we need to take that? Do we really need to say, sorry, mom and dad, we can't hang out, or you can't see the baby, or you can't do that? You know, like, and how we're just talking, half of the conversation you just had with Sarah was all about the cruelty and actual the immune compromising effects of isolation itself.
Yep.
So are we going to be forced to isolate in order to save some significant part of the population? I don't know. That's what I've been asking myself for a while. Those answers have been elusive, I should say.
Yeah, I do know this. You know, as the South begins its downturn of this wave, which is happening here in South Carolina, it's obviously happening in Florida. The Northeast now will pick up. That's what we've seen generally throughout this. So while the South and, you know, the Southeast and the Southwest seem to be kind of tamping down a little bit, it doesn't seem like this virus is a winter virus for us here. It's a summer virus for us here, a warmer month virus, because I don't know. It doesn't matter what time of year it is. If it's out there, it's out there. And I don't know what else to say. We've really done our best here to educate people. There are early things that you can do to keep yourself healthy that will give you, a much better chance of just sailing right through COVID like most people do. And if you get very sick, there are things you can do still at home without having to be admitted to a hospital, where it seems, in my personal experience, they're not doing much to help and doing a lot of things that will harm you. And I guess that's it.
Yeah.
Well, you have been listening to the somewhat somber Monday edition of the Dark to Light podcast with
Frankie Val on the drums and
Beans. You can hear us every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 2:30 Eastern Time on TuneIn, Stitcher, Apple iTunes, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and RadioInfluence.com. We'll see you on Wednesday.
Later.
This week on Crush Performance, it's episode number 4 of our Science of Sweetness series, brought to you by the Brix Glycemic Impact Research and Science Institute. This week, we review some of the hardcore science showing how the food you eat impacts your brain, and we answer some very important questions from you, our audience, on the foods you're eating, why they may be bad for you, and most importantly, we discuss how you can fix some of the foods you eat as we begin to teach you how to properly code your foods. It's Food Fixing 101 on this week's episode of Crush Performance.
Crush Performance with Jeff Crochelle can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RadioInfluence.com.